Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
If only I could turn the clock back. If only I had known now what I... Well, if only I could have known then what I know now. Huh. Can you imagine if you could turn the clock back to 1967? How would your life... How would you have run your life differently? Here's what I want to do today. Let's listen to the music a little bit, please, louder. Gentle people, right. Drug addicts, LSD maniacs, communists, socialists. Everyone I ever met in the hippie era either wanted to, steal your money or do your old lady. But they had long hair, you know, the granny glasses. You know who they are, the ones who work for Obama today. Either that or they became lawyers. Or they became lawyers and worked for Obama, since he's a lawyer. Yeah, did you see that story today in the Washington Post about Obama's Indonesian gay nanny and other things from his past? I know this is a very sensitive issue. I didn't write the story. The Washington Post did, quoting the New York Times, is that he was raised by an Indonesian gay nanny who later joined a group of transvestites called Fantastic Dolls, who, like the many transvestites who remain fixtures of Jakarta, Indonesia's streets, entertained people by dancing and playing volleyball. I don't know whether this is important or not, but I thought I would. How in the world is this? Is this important? They say that when he was a child back in Indonesia, while his mom, Mrs. Obama, whatever her name was, going from village to village on a motorbike doing anthropology, and Obama was in a madrasas, they said he was known as Chubby, and that some of the locals referred to him as the boy who runs like a duck. Well, I don't care that he ran like a duck. I mean, the guy rules like a duck. That's the truth. And as far as the openly gay man, blah, 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 what does that have to do with anything? What this really says to me is that that's why he has trouble relating to the average American, is because he didn't have an experience that was American. All of his experiences were that of a third world child, or of, let us say, the child of a college teacher who traipsed around the world. Now, I'm sensitive to this because in some of the early years of my life, I traipsed around the islands of the South Seas and took my children with me. The difference is that they didn't become communists, nor socialists, and they love America. That's a little difference. Go explain that one to me. So in the sense that it doesn't matter what your parents, you know, put you through, as long as they tell you to, well, I can't summarize. So here we are. And here's what I want to do today in the Savage Nation. I don't know what I want to do in the Savage Nation, except this. We keep hearing that a million people are about to lose their houses under Obama. We hear the unemployment rate is 10 to 15%. We hear the economy is in meltdown. And yet you look around, the restaurants seem to be full. People seem to be going about their normal way. I mean, I don't see the... Where is this poverty is what I want to know. And here's what why I'm asking it. Because maybe this is a myth of the right wing in order to debase the great man, the great president, the great imposter Obama, who, as you well know, has every right to spend $200 million a day on a vacation because he worked very hard trying to get other socialists elected, and he failed. He's entitled to take the entire U.S. Air Force and half the Navy with him in order to have a nice vacation. Why shouldn't he have a nice vacation in India and in his homeland of Indonesia? I really think that it's really mean of you right-wingers to think he shouldn't take so many 3,000 people in an entourage. Why should he be lonely? He's entitled to 3,000 friends to travel with him. And then, of course, he needs the flax on the airplane known as the press corps to put out as positive an image as possible. I would like to hear the 10, and I don't mean this to be, I have to put, I thought about this for 4 days now. So I may not get it just right. I'm going to try to do this in a sensitive manner. I want to hear the 10 stories from you, the caller, about how your life has gone downhill since Obama took office, meaning financially. I want to hear the 10 worst sob stories so that we can feel some truth of this. In other words, is someone really suffering out there? Or is it all belly aching because you really just want, I don't know, Republican, whatever. And the 10 best stories about trickle-up poverty in your own life will win you a copy of this raging bestseller that will be sure to be worth a fortune on the Antiques Roadshow in the year 3011. 1-800-449-1800. Well, my great-granddaddy, when there was still a thing called books, he bought this from a guy who used to be on a thing called radio. Yeah, radio. Something to do with an instrument like a microphone or something, where a guy talked and they listened and they actually printed stuff on paper. Well, how much is that worth today? 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number, michaelsavage.com. Obama's Indonesian gay nanny and other things from his past. That's not the most interesting story. Here's the most telling of his trip to Indonesia. Obama visiting Muslim shrine in India, no plans to visit Hindu, Buddhist, or other shrines. Obama is visiting Humayun's tomb, who this guy was a 16th century Mughal empire, whose empire encompassed modern-day Pakistan, Afghanistan, and parts of northern India. He is visiting a Muslim shrine, but the great man has no plans to visit any holy places of the Sikhs, such as the Golden Temple, or any Hindu holy places, or any Buddhist holy places, or any Jain holy places, nor does he plan to visit the Chabad house in Mumbai that was the chief target of the jihad throat-cutting vermin who killed 173 people in November of 08, including this young Jewish family in front of their children. And so he's not even going to visit the Chabad house. So once again, Obama is manifesting a solicitude for Islam that he wouldn't dream of extending to other faiths. And you got to ask yourself, are they going to block the reporters so we don't see pictures and get reports of what he's really doing? He only goes to a Muslim shrine. He won't even go to a Hindu shrine in a Hindu nation. Something's wrong with this picture, unless you're one of the people who finally awakened to what he is actually doing. Now, I had two offers for interviews today, both of which I turned down. One came to me from the BBC, who wanted to ask me to appear on the BBC today on what I thought of Obama being in Indonesia. But they said I could not mention the fact that they had banned me from their own nation of Britain. I said, thank you, no. The other was sent to me by a friend in the media who said that Bloomberg TV and NPR wanted to interview me on the topic of income inequality. And they baited me by saying this will be heard by 260 million homes and on 220 NPR stations. They wanted to interview me on the topic of income inequality. So I said no to that one, too. I said, no doubt they wanted me to play the evil capitalist. For example, what in the hell does income inequality even mean? There are people living halfway around the world who don't make as much as I do, and that's supposed to be my problem? I'm supposed to worry about them? Somehow, for thousands of years, people outside the Western nations, and most people in the West as well, managed to survive without some communists saying they should all be millionaires. Why does the left wing insist on forcing their guilt on the rest of us? Income inequality, the words themselves are offensive. Now let's go to the sad stories out there in the Savage Nation. Remember, the best 10 stories about how your life has gone downhill under Obama wins copies of Trickle Up Poverty. And I'm not kidding you. This is not just to, you know, make a joke of you. I will not play with you. I want the world to hear what you're going through. You got it? Be serious. Kevin in San Diego, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael, thanks for the time. I basically had lost every house I had. In 2007, we had the banks go out of business one after the other, and our actual, you know, value of all of our homes has been turned into nothing.
Well, wait, let me see if I understand. You had a principal home and several investment properties, Kevin?
Right. Several investment properties, I had a lot of money in a building project, and that money basically evaporated overnight.
Are you a contractor, Kevin?
Contractor in California.
Oh my God! So you worked your way up from being a carpenter, no doubt, correct?
Absolutely.
So you started doing carpentry. You saved your money. You invested it in the fixer-upper, and you made a little money, et cetera, and so on, correct?
Yes, Michael, and with that, I was, you know, trying to be wise about it. I had basically a 20% protection value in each home, making sure that if the market went down, you know, I wasn't trying to over-exasperate with what the market was. We knew, you know, the rise of prices on homes. But after one bank after the other went out of business on us, literally, my home of $1.7 million wound up selling for $850,000.
Oof.
And as the banks wound up getting the bailouts, Chase, being one of them, turned around and refused to remodify the very last home I had left to resalvage. Now, I quickly went and reevaluated and went into trying to protect my business with, you know, foreclosure cleanups and
so there was no money for you. There was, whatever the government put out as propaganda, there was nothing. No door was open to you.
Even with all of the bills that even Governor Schwarzenegger passed, didn't even protect me at all.
How many houses did you lose, Kevin?
I lost 4 total.
Oh my God! So what are you doing now?
Basically, I had to reinvent myself, Michael. We, you know, very passionate, very patriotic. I work with athletes now specifically and out of high school in trying to help them find places to go, you know, pursue their career. And,
so are you a counselor or a teacher or what?
No, just, you know, on the side, basically working with athletes and had an opportunity to...
How are you making a living, though?
Basically, right now, it's, you know, it's tough. It's tight.
Are you married with children?
Married with children. You know, we, you know, from the construction standpoint, unless you're a large company that's working in the government...
Yeah, but all I can offer you is this, Kevin, and I'm not going to mention names. I knew through family... through family friends, a business that had something like 6,000 to 9,000 houses in developments under construction at any one time in the peak. And they were people who had inherited a lot of money through 3 generations of very hard work. And the man had his own private jet and et cetera. Do you know that when this collapsed, he lost everything?
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm trying to say, Kevin, is don't think that there's something wrong in your thinking. Or see, what happens to a man is that when he loses like this, he thinks it's him, that he did something wrong. He failed his wife and children, that there's inherently a flaw in him. And that's the worst thing, because once you go down that road, you can't come back from that. You have to understand what it is. It's like a tsunami or a tidal wave. The strongest man on earth, the best swimmer, cannot escape the tidal wave. And that's what you got hit with, Kevin.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you've been an encouragement to me. I know that there are a lot of us out there, but I think the one thing that I continue to tell my own kids is I refuse to quit. The American dream is still acceptable.
Don't quit. Don't quit. Kevin, I I'm hitting up a break. I got to tell you, my son was in college or whatever. I was at a point in my life, I don't remember the year, but I had a couple of consulting things going, and everything went bad on me. I don't know what year it was, 1990. Everything went bad. No matter what I did, I drilled every well in the world. I couldn't sell a new book. I couldn't start a new this. No, nothing would work. It was all bad. I was ready to 1992. I was ready to give up and just give up and quit, basically, and live on very little for the rest of my life. At the time, my son was just getting out of college. And I told him I wanted to quit. I wanted to retire. I couldn't take it anymore. I was going to die from the stress. And he looked at me because I raised him tough. You know what he said? You can't quit. You're too young. I got so angry, I chased him out of the house for a minute, I ran out screaming at him. How dare you say that to me? I'm your father. And guess what? Halfway down the block, I stopped and realized he was right. You know what I did, Kevin? Hold on. I'll tell you when I come back because it's an incredible story. Stay there.
Savage.
All right, you know, say misery loves company, but a lot of what you're hearing in the media, you don't want to believe. Many of you are doing as well as you did before, if not better. But we keep hearing things are not well, things are not good, and we don't know exactly who's being touched by the downturn. So I thought that for a while on the Savage Nation today, I would ask for the 10, let us say, most tragic stories. We just heard one from a contractor who lost all his houses. Now, I know many of you left-wing vermin we're happy to hear that story because you've produced nothing in your life except hate. Your whole life has been spent lying and cheating and hating everyone. That's all you're good for. Here's a man who started as a carpenter, worked his way up, invested his money, something you didn't have the guts to do, and he did. And he took his chances, and then it all dissolved at the end because the economy turned on him. I started to tell you a story. I got 48 seconds to finish it. My son said, "You're too young to quit." I was 50 years of age. I said, "How dare you? I'm your father." And then halfway down the street, I stopped and said, "He's right." I came back. I reinvented myself. I had a successful career as a writer up to a certain point, many successful books, but nothing was working. I went out. I got a list of 410 radio stations in the country. I created a tape, a radio tape. And now from high atop the Empire State Building, it's Michael Savage and the Savage Nation. And I got some stations, four of them, in fact, said, "You're pretty good." And that's how I started a whole new career. It's an absolutely true story. Don't give up.
Savage.
So what we're doing is making it very personal. I've asked you to call with a tragedy, your own personal story, if you're doing worse under Obama. And we're getting calls. Some of them, as the one, I mean, you've only got one, but it may typify tens of thousands of men who started out as contractors working for someone else, saw the money that was being made. Instead of spending it on a new car or putting it up their nose, they put it aside, they bought a little house. They put their sweat into it, their sweat equity. They hired a couple of guys. They fixed it up. They made 50 grand on the first house. And they said, "This ain't bad." Then they parlayed that into the next house, etc. And all of a sudden, the whole thing came down. Many of you don't understand what it takes to invest and to put in sweat equity. You don't even understand it if you've not done it. But most of you who listen to this show understand that that is the American way to build a fortune. Unless you're a politician or a crook related to a politician. Now, I got to go back for a minute because this is only one man's opinion. When Obama took power after the fake collapse of the economy that was engineered by several money individuals in order to foist this man upon us, and believe me, I believe I have the evidence to prove that in my book. I lay it out. If you don't want to read it, then don't even comment. Then just keep smoking your joint and think you know everything. On the other hand, when this happened and the Democrats came to power, and everyone said, "Oh, it's all coming to an end." I said, "Look, don't be a fool." I said, "There are still going to be rich, only they're going to be a different gang of rich." They said, "What do you mean by that?" I said, "The guys related to the K Street gang in the Republican side who've been buying the big houses and the boats and the private jets, they're not going to be buying the houses, boats, and jets." They said, "Well, who's going to buy them then? After all, he's a left-winger." I said, "Never mind, left-winger, schmeft-winger." I said, "It's all money." I said, "You wait and see. The big houses are still going to sell. The big yachts are going to sell, and the private jets are going to sell." Well, sure enough, that's what's happening. Perhaps not as the same price, but I happen to know for a fact that the upper-end real estate is still selling. The highest-end real estate is still selling. I know someone in the boating industry who told me that any yacht over 100 feet, they can't even make them fast enough. Mega yachts, in other words, 100 feet plus, the yards are backed up. Anything below 100 feet isn't selling. So in other words, who has the money? Well, I'll let you answer your own question. I'll be your father now. You're asking who got the money? How did they get this money to buy the mega yacht and buy a jet? The next time you're driving around your city and you see cranes and lights on it in the middle of the night working on a recovery project, a stimulus project, and you realize it was a no-bid contract, you'll figure out where the money came from. That's number one. So it's different groups got the money this time. That's all. It doesn't mean that... Now, on the other hand, there is a middle class that's evaporating under Obama because that's what he wants. Make no mistake about it. He was raised in a communist environment. He was raised to detest the middle class, which they denigrated by calling you the bourgeoisie. They made them think that they were intellectually superior to you by using a French communist word, bourgeoisie, as though it was something contemptible to want to earn money and save money and build something for your family. So all of the hippies sneered at you, and now that the hippies are running America, they have targeted you, and they've attacked you, and that's why I wrote Trickle Up Poverty. But I want to get back to the stories that we're getting at on the Savage Nation, because I'm going to give out books to these stories. It's the only thing I can offer you right now. Have you really been hit by this? What really happened? Let's ask Michelle in New York on WOR. Michelle, go ahead, please.
Well, as a person who runs a small business for a master plumber that works New York City, I could have hired an extra helper for the $40,000 that it cost me in unemployment insurance due to all the extensions to 99 weeks. In my industry, let me tell you, plumbers work in New York City. You got to be lazy or you have to have a bad attendance not to find a job.
Where? Right now in New York, you say people can find jobs.
If you can work as a plumber, yes, you can. We're not a new construction company.
Oh, a plumber. You're saying plumbing.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Fixing things up or new construction?
No, I mean jobbing, like fixing faucets, stoppages, things like that. We started in 2002 with one truck. We have 15 trucks now. But I can't expand under Obama.
Why?
Due to the fact that he's making it physically impossible financially to do it. I would love to be able to hire an extra person because gosh knows I need it, but I can't with the money that he has cost me.
How has the Obama administration cost you money as a businesswoman?
As a person who runs a business for someone else, it's actually my insurance. When I went out to shop out my insurance every year, my liability was okay. My health insurance from all the health insurance companies being so scared went up 19% this year. I try and keep a very cost-effective copay for my guys. I try and keep their prescription. And the worst thing is,
isn't New York a workers' comp? A workers' comp nightmare for businesses. Isn't it the worst in America? I understand from business people that New York State is the worst workers' comp ripoff in the entire country.
You have the state insurance fund, because if you don't apply with the state insurance fund, you're going to wind up in a company that doesn't back when, God forbid, something happens. And the state insurance fund even went up with their workman's comp this year. I usually would get a better rebate.
Well, isn't there a high amount of fake people claiming injuries with shyster lawyers to go out on workers' comp?
I do believe, and I have seen, and every case that I do see, I fight amongst my employees that try to pull that on me. But being the liberal state that it is, they stand a lot better chance than I do.
All right. So the bottom line from you is, as a woman who manages a plumbing contracting business, you'd like to expand, but you can't, owing to the red tape and the cost of doing business in New York State. Michelle, I'm sending you a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. Thank you for that. San Diego, let's go across the country now. Scott, what happened to you under Obama?
Mr. Savage, I had a custom cabinet shop. My situation right now is I live in my 28-foot fifth wheel with my wife and three kids.
Oh, my God. Now, and when you say custom cabinet, you mean you build cabinets for people, homeowners?
Some Yeah, I did the retail and did homeowners. I started it in 05, was doing six figures by 07, bought a house in 06. And one by one, my employees left. I had to work out of my garage to finish my last job.
Oh, heartbreaking, heartbreaking. So you're a skilled craftsman, in essence, and you have no work.
Correct. And the cabinet shops, there's 1,000 guys looking for work. You can't even get a job at it.
Isn't that sad? That's heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. So what are you doing? What are you living on?
Odd and ends, handyman stuff.
Oh, my God. I don't even have any words for this, Scott. There's nothing a person can say that would give you any comfort, is there?
You know, I'm a little emotional, Mike, but you know what? I'll get back on my feet. Things will work out. But I, like I said, I will not take welfare or nothing.
Well, let me say this, Scott, and this is a very sensitive issue. Don't let your pride interfere with your survival. At a certain point, you know, you got to take care of yourself and your family. And if the government's going to give you something, you know, you should get it first instead of some illegal alien leech.
Well, you know, Michael, we're in the trailer. We're fine. Actually, it's not that bad because I spend a lot of time with my kids. And we're getting along, you know, so I'm not in a house.
Yeah, well, what are you doing for money for food, though?
Well, I do odd and end stuff. You know, I make a couple of hundred here, make a few hundred there.
But what, you mean as a woodworker or as a repairman?
Repairing things, day labor.
Scott, what kind of woodworking did you do? Tell me what type of work you did.
I made Highline custom cabinets for residents.
And you were a carpenter in essence?
Yes.
You are a carpenter, not were. You are a carpenter.
Yeah.
And you did for the high-end custom homes, is that it?
And mid-sized homes. My average kitchen was 30 to 40,000, but then there was...
And how did you begin? How did you start out learning to do this?
Well, I started out in my early 20s doing Formica countertops, then I got into refacing, and then I got into doing it. I got my license and opened my own
shop. What if somebody is listening to this show right now, Scott, who says, I want Scott to do some cabinetry for me? How could they reach you?
My phone, my email?
I'll tell you what, instead of putting it on the air, Scott, I'm going to ask you to give it to my producer. And if there's anyone out there who needs any work in the San Diego or Los Angeles area, would you please call 1-800-449-8255, Beowulf? Isn't that the best way to do this? We're going to try and make something right here, Scott. Stay on the line, and I'm going to send you a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. I mean, I'm going to make something. I want to be proactive here. I don't just want to exploit people for their bad stories. You know, I don't want to be like so many people in the media who simply are like vultures looking to hear what's bad so you keep listening. You know, it's like sucking air into a tooth that has a hole in it. People go, you know, suck it in just to feel the pain. I don't want to do that. It's really hard to listen to these stories in a way. But maybe we need to hear it to understand what kind of... lives are out. These are lives. These are real lives. It's as real as your toothbrush sitting on your cup in your cup in a bathroom. That story was as real as your used toothbrush sitting in your cup in the bathroom. That's reality. Okay, this is reality. Never mind all of the hot air. That's reality. There's a man who was, you know, doing something with his hands, making an honest living, and now because of the money managers out there, he's got nothing. Living in a trailer trying to hold on without cracking up from the strain. Hartford, Connecticut. Cameron, you're on the Savage Nation. Cameron, go ahead, please. All right. Out of that one. Tucson, Arizona. Rick, you're next up. Go ahead, please. Topic on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike. Actually, I'm sorry to disappoint. I don't have a bad story. I was going to offer kind of like an encouraging story if I could. Obviously, I live in Tucson. When Obama was elected, I was a little bit nervous, you know, but I basically just put it out of my mind then and decided that regardless of whoever's in office and regardless of what the economy does, I'm just going to do everything I can and work as hard as I can to not suffer. And that way, whether things recover or don't recover, I can say whatever happened, it was...
But has your life changed in any way? Do you eat out less? Do you travel less? No vacations? What's the difference?
Yeah, my life has changed a little bit. I mean, things are a little bit more tight, I guess. But, that's because we also bought a house. But I've actually made a little bit more just because I've been determined to make a little bit more. I don't really have the job that allows me to make a ton of money. But, my life is changing now. I'm also going back to school because I don't want to be doing sales for the rest of my life.
Well, I'm sending you a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. Please stay on the line. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I feel the Indonesian for the people here, and obviously, I have a sister who's half Indonesian. My mother lived and worked here for a long time. And so the sights and the sounds and the memories all feel very familiar. And it's wonderful to be able to come back as president and hopefully contribute to further understanding between the United States and Indonesia.
On the last I checked, it had the largest Muslim population, I think, of all nations. Is that still true? Yeah. Quite a history, too, if you look into it. Check out the number of Catholics that were slaughtered in Indonesia during some of the riots about 20 years ago. Have you seen that in the history, in the coverage of Indonesia? Fabulous country, very kind, gentle people. Many of you go to the third world restaurants and you see the libs from the universities bowing when they come in and putting their hands together, asking for a glass of water or a napkin, saying thank you and please so many times that the owners go in the kitchen and can hardly stand the laughter from the staff when they see the white libs bowing to them. And it's a fabulous country to visit. You ought to read what, the famous anthropologist from many years ago, Margaret Mead. Many of you heard the name, you may remember it. Well, she had a husband named Marston Bates. I know it sounds like his name was Marston Bates. He spent a lot of time in Bali. You say, oh, Bali, yeah, wonderful place. Superior, like nice, colorful outfits, and they dance so nice. They're very peace-loving. If you ever read what Marston Bates wrote about the people in Bali, the Balinese, you'd be shocked. It wouldn't be my words, it would be his, but you don't want to hear any of this. He talks about them spitting up the red, slimy spittle from their mouths from chewing betel nut and the other hygienic wonders of Bali that you don't read about in tourist brochures. But aside from the hygienic aspects of Bali, he talks about the people themselves, and none of it is positive. Here's a man who lived there, worked there, was an anthropologist there, not me. But this is like what you're watching now is sort of a Disney-esque fantasy of Indonesia from Obama. The man, I have no idea what he's doing. Sounds like he's just taking a trip. He needed half the Air Force and half the Navy with him to go on a vacation because he just worked so hard wrecking the Democrat Party. Now, if you think you're the only one suffering right now with grief because of your economic woes, a report just came out of Congress where they're giving out grief counseling for the youngsters who lost their jobs as staffers amongst the Demon Cats. They've actually hired counselors to help the others with their emotional loss. And each staffer who lost their job because their Democrat was fired was given a booklet on how to deal with grief and the stages of grief. You know, but I really have no sympathy for the staffers because, frankly, most of them are trust fund kids anyway. They're just in D.C. looking for a husband, whether they're a man or a woman, they're looking for a husband. Symbol shot. The important thing to know is that with Obamacare, the kids will have coverage till they're 26 now because the taxpayers have to support them. I have no idea what these young parasites are going to do now. There's no way there's no jobs for them in Starbucks is all full up. All the barrister positions are taken. What can a staffer do who just lost his job? Let's say you were a staffer for a Democrat who just got thrown out of office. 60 of them lost. 60 staff. So each had what? How? God knows how many staff. That's 100, 200? Let's say 240 staffers are now looking for work in Washington, D.C. I have no idea what they could do. Truthfully, I don't know. It's a tough world out there. They're going to be looking for work like the rest of the American people out there. I mean, this is social justice. This is social justice, and this is the environment that the liberals created And the question is what they're going to do now. They certainly couldn't go to work for a corporation because they hate corporations, don't they? They couldn't get a job on Wall Street because they hate Wall Street. Right? I mean, come on. You know, these kids who are working, who would work for Democrats are all commie socialist lunatics, brainwashed. I don't blame them. They've been brainwashed since birth. They wouldn't take a job for a corporation, would they? An evil American corporation? No. Would they take a job on Wall Street, evil Wall Street? No, nah, they're not fit for it. So what's left for these children? I don't know. I guess they're going to have a little time in their hands to read the Obamacare bill. I mean, I'd send 200 copies of Trickle Up Poverty to them. Maybe they'll wake up now and become real Americans. But here's the five stages of Democratic grief. One, blame Nixon. Two, blame Bush. Three, anger. Why didn't the idiotic, dumb voters out there, the bourgeoisie, understand we were better than the Republicans? Four, bargaining. Bargaining with their... Five, depression. The country is on the brink of a depression. I'm no difference. Different. Six, acceptance. Yes, it was Nixon's fault. And now, of course, the only thing they have left is their parents to fall back upon and the fact that the Obamacare will carry them till they're 26 years of age. It seems like we raised the nation of babies, and they don't want to leave mom's basement. It's like Wayne's World. These bureaucratic Democrat leeches are like Wayne's World, you know, with Wayne's World. Wayne's World. They could all go to work for Bonnie Frank, couldn't they? He's still in business. Look, all of them have to understand that things happen. You know, S happens, and it happened to them. Maybe they'll have sympathy for those of you who are not in a staff position.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Trying to do is to make sure that we are building bridges and expanding our interactions with Muslim countries so that they're not solely focused on security issues.
Okay, just the music, please. Because just music, just music. We're playing Indonesian gamelan music. I actually used to collect this stuff when I was a graduate student until I almost went mad from it. I gave it all away. If you listen to this long enough, you'll lose your mind, I can guarantee you. It slows you down like HAL 2000, Welcome to the Savage Nation. Look, different strokes for different folks. Obama's Indonesian gay nanny and other things from his past came out today. It shouldn't matter. It's part of the multicultural background of the president, which makes him so much broader than the average Neanderthal-esque Republican. Because this man has expanded his consciousness in a way that only liberals can appreciate. You Neanderthals on the right can't understand how superior and advanced the president is. I mean, in essence, he's our first Muslim president. Whether he's Muslim or not doesn't matter. His outreach to Muslims is something to be admired, isn't it? And his understanding of the Muslim people seems to be greater than his understanding of Middle America. That's to be admired, since there's more Muslims than Middle Americans. So in that sense, I mean, you people are not looking at things correctly. You know, you got to look at things in a broader way, in a more encompassing way. Play the music again, the gamelan music, because it makes me want to have Indonesian food. I'm a very funny guy. The minute I hear a certain ethnic music, I think that's what I'm... I mean, the food... There aren't any Indonesian restaurants really around. There's one in the whole area. They used to be big in the 70s. The rice table. I happen to be a big fan of Asian food, if you can find any that's good. I like Japanese. I had a good Japanese lunch. The guy made the best gyoza I've ever had. I had to leave the seat twice. Two moves, that's all. I go in at noon. The place is empty. I figured I'd catch it early, an early job. The guy was nice. Sit wherever you want. So I sit at the counter. No one's there. At the end now, in comes an old guy. He sits right next to me. It must be 30 seats. The old geezer has to sit next to me. And I said, oh, God, I just want to be left alone. So I don't care about him. I figured I move all the way down to the end now. Then all of a sudden, as my gyoza arrive and the fish, five illegal alien workers arrive and start speaking in a foreign dialect. Which, again, all right, it's part of the experience. I got to lighten up. You know what I mean? Enjoy the multiculturalism of the Bay Area. I wouldn't expect anyone to speak English in a restaurant. Well, I mean, that would be almost racist to expect anyone to speak English. The food was excellent, though. The gyoza was terrific. But the minute someone sits next to me, I start, like, I can't eat. I can't digest. I start to gag. They talk too loud. And that's the problem. Look, maybe it's a phobia of some kind. I don't know, restrophobia. So the reason we're playing Indonesian gamelan music on the Savage Nation is to entertain you and to show you how smart we are. We know everything. It's because Obama's there and he's reaching out to Muslims, not to Hindus in India. He didn't reach out to the Hindus in India. He didn't reach out to the Jews who were slaughtered like animals by the vermin who came in there to Mumbai, which you forgot about. No, none of that. President, and then he attacked Israel, a little backhanded slap in Israel. In a Muslim nation, he attacks Israel at the same time. So, what is this Jack Kerouac being interviewed by William F. Buckley? Where'd you get this, Beowulf? Why is this here today? Oh, Literature Day. Did we ever play this on the show yet? Is it good? Him and William F. Buckley Jr.? Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road on the Steve Allen Show from 1959. Let me hear that one, clip 18.
Anyway, I wrote the book because we're all going to die. In the loneliness of my life, my father dead, my brother dead, my mother far away, my sister and my wife far away. Nothing here but my own tragic hands that once were guarded by the world, a sweet attention, that now are left to guide and disappear their own way into the common dark of all our deaths. Sleeping in me raw, bed alone and stupid, with just this one pride and consolation. My heart broke in a general despair and opened up inwards to the Lord. I made a supplication in this dream. On the last page of On the Road, I describe how the hero, Dean Moriarty's come to see me all the way from the West Coast just for a day or two. We've just been back and forth across the country several times in cars and now our adventures are over. We're still great friends, but we have to go into later phases of our lives. So there he goes, Dean Moriarty, ragged in the moth-eaten overcoat he brought specially for the freezing temperatures of the East. Walking off alone, and last I saw him, he rounded the corner of 7th Avenue, eyes on the street ahead, and bent to it again. Gone. So, in America...
Right on.
And the sun goes down...
All right, not bad. I mean, come on, this guy is the best. He was the best of all of them. And what you don't know if you went to a liberal arts college is that Jack Kerouac, who was the granddaddy of the Beats, was a Republican, loved Nixon, pro-war, hated Allen Ginsberg as a dirtbag. None of that is taught to you in the colleges because most of your teachers reflect the last thing I just told you about Ginsberg in themselves, in their raw beds alone. Their hearts not broken, but needing to be broken. Because they haven't opened up to the Lord, because Kerouac himself was a devout Catholic who died in his mother's house, an alcoholic in Florida with a boinged up spring chair because he couldn't take it anymore. By the way, what does that have to do with Obama in Indonesia? Why, nothing, I say, but I'm playing it, you see, because there it is, on the road for all of us. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. So before I got distracted on the Savage Nation with my minimal ADD, see, I mean, some call me a genius. Some say I have ADD. But, of course, then they catch themselves and realize if they're trying to put me down with an ailment, why, then they're caught in the conundrum of putting down a person with a disability, and that's not PC. Therefore, they're tongue-tied, so they just don't call the show, you see. And so we looked up someone who knew a lot about Bali and Indonesia way back before Bali and Indonesia became a tourist destination on a postcard, and that was a man named Gregory Bateson. I had it wrong before. When I said Marston Bates, I was thinking of an act rather than a person. Gregory Bateson, you see, was the husband of the infamous lying anthropologist Margaret Mead, who made it all up about the sex life of savages. She invented, she put down in her books and called it anthropology. But Gregory Bateson was her husband, actually wasn't her original husband, but that happens, you see. He was actually someone she met on a road trip, and then, of course, got entranced with and danced with. And so Gregory Bateson spent a lot of time in Bali, Indonesia, and he actually created a short documentary film with his wife, Margaret Mead, entitled Trance and Dance in Bali. That's right, Trance and Dance in Bali. And right now Obama is in Indonesia. I don't know whether he's trancing, but I know he danced in India. The fact of the matter is Gregory Bateson in Bali is quite an experience for those of you who read your anthropology in college. If you want to look it up and see if I'm fibbing or making it up just to put down third worlders, you'll find out that I'm not. I'm doing a documentary, I assure you, because it turns out Gregory Bateson didn't like the Balinese. In fact, he detested them, couldn't stand their hygiene, hated them constantly spitting up the betel nut juice from chewing the old betel nut. More than that, he couldn't stand anything about the culture because he went past the postcard imagery that most of us don't understand exists beyond the three-dimensional, two-dimensional, one-dimensional, half-dimensional hollow men that create the travel postcards for all of us to take cruise ships that go dead in the sea with no elevators, no air conditioning, no electricity, and no water, no plumbing, no hot food, having to be rescued by Coast Guard in Mexico off the coast because the giant cruise ship with 3,000 people and 1,200 staff dead in the water. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
It's just a movement which is supposed to be licentious, but it isn't really.
Well, not licentious in what respect?
The hippies are good kids. They're better than the Beats. See, Ginsberg and I, and, well, Ginsberg, boy. We're 40. We're all in our 40s. Mm-hmm. And we started this, and the kids took it up and everything. But a lot of hoodlums and communists jumped on our backs. Mm-hmm. Well, on my back, not his. Mm-hmm. Ferlinghetti jumped on my back and turned the idea that I had that the B generation was a generation of beatitude and pleasure in life and tenderness. But they called it, in the papers, beat mutiny, beat insurrection. Words I never used, being a Catholic.
See, they leave that out. The man was a devout Catholic, total believer in God, and a tremendously compassionate man. I'm talking about Jack Kerouac, and that was him being interviewed by William F. Buckley Jr. on the Beat Movement. It has nothing to do with anything. I just thought I'd throw it in for fun because we were talking earlier about real job losses, real income loss, what happened to you under the mysterious monetary trail of Obama. How come he's spending $200 million a day and taking a good portion of the Air Force and Navy with them on a holiday to Indonesia, Indonesia and Points East. And I told you I'd be giving out, you know, gifts to those of you who have the most tragic story. So let's go back to the reality, the realpolitik of the moment on the Savage Nation. Linda in San Diego, welcome to the program. What's going on?
Well, I thank you, one, for giving a voice to a frustrated woman, and two, for getting rid of that Indonesian music, because it reminded me of a time when I had a job on a mall here in San Diego with the Hare Krishna outside.
Oh, my God. You mean when I play the Hare Krishna music, you get a little upset?
Don't do that, please.
All right, we won't do it. I was going to play. I happen to like the Hare Krishna music. Apparently, the president must like Hare Krishna music. He went all the way to India for it. So what's on your mind?
Michael, if you want to listen to that, I would gladly put you in my shoes in that shoe store on the mall and listen to it over and over and over all day long. There was.
You mean they were outside your shoe store dancing with the cymbals?
Yes, and it was at the same time that that song, "Bye Bye Miss American Pie," drove my Chevy to the levee. It was almost as obnoxious as the Hare Krishna outside because.
So how are you surviving? But the point is on the economics. Are you doing better or worse under Obama?
I'm only doing better because of what I inherited. Because we're doing far worse. We tried to refinance our home. We lost it. There was no refinancing available. We couldn't find one. We tried here. We tried there.
But your call says Linda's calling, and it says father is only reason. What does that mean?
That means I'm living in the property that my father bought and built. He bought it in 1960. It was a small two bedroom one bath house here in San Diego.
But you're not feeling embarrassed, are you?
Oh no, I love my place. Michael, you should come visit my house. I've got a great view of Point Loma and a little bit of the water. All right.
Well, I saw Play Misty for me. So, Linda, you're living with Dad. How is he faring in these times?
Well, I'm sad to say my father died 8 years ago, and my mother died last year. So it's my house.
But you're living alone in the house you inherited.
I'm living with my husband in the house I inherited.
And where do you have money? Where's the money coming from?
Right now, we're not sure because he's on disability. I can't work because of disabilities, and we're just trying to go from day to day.
Well, maybe you should consider joining the Krishna movement, because think of the body movement that you'd get into. You could collect alms and meet some nice, interesting people who are spiritually advanced.
We consider ourselves spiritually just fine, and that's
sorry. Come on, I'm joking. I'm joking. I wouldn't suggest that. I mean, if you want to, fine, you know. They look like they had a good time. It was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, wasn't it? Always got the usually girl inheritance cases wound up dancing with him. Who was that guy from Antelope, Oregon in the 70s? Remember that Maharishi with the Rolls Royces? Remember that age?
Oh, gosh, Michael, you know what? I never smoked a joint in my life. I never smoked a cigarette in my life.
Well, then you couldn't work for the Obama administration. In fact, one of the qualifications for the Democrat Party is you need to have smoked several and inhaled it. Linda, I'm sending you a copy of Trickle Up Poverty because you're such a good sport. Let's go to Will in Chicago. Will, what happened to you under the Obama economics?
Hey, doctor. Yeah, in a nutshell, first, my wife lost her job after 10 years, 100 people all gone one day, just canned them. And then our property taxes went through the roof out here in Cook County. They cut off my – I'm the only breadwinner in the house trying to put my kids through school. And – basically, like I said, property taxes went to the roof. They cut my hours down to bare minimum. And the only reason, you know, my wife, like I said, lost her job. She's too proud to take unemployment. She got a little part-time job.
Well, you got to support Blagojevich's ex-empire. And also you have to support Rahm Emanuel's desires, right, Will? That's what the taxes are for.
Exactly. But I'll tell you the one thing that hurts the most. I used to, you know, I lost my house. That's gone. We're living in a two-bedroom apartment, like I said, and trying to put the kids through school.
Oh,
but the part
that's
the worst, I used to buy my wife flowers every week, fresh flowers, because she loved them so much. I can't even afford to do that anymore.
That's sad. Look, Will, I got to tell you this, and again, it's not like I've had the worst things happen to me. Believe me, I'm, you know. I was living in a small house, and then I saved enough money over 10 years to buy a little investment house way back when, and I had tenants in it. Things went so bad, I had to move into my rental house, okay? Things happen, Will, and that's when I hit bottom, and that's when I sent out those 400 copies of my Savage Nation test tape, the demo tape, and it led to 16 incredible years in the radio business. I mean, anything could happen, but you gotta not, you can't give up. That's the point. You give up and all is lost, right, Will? I'm sending you Trickle Up Poverty. Keep fighting.
Savage.
Well, the president is having his multicultural experience in India, now Indonesia, God knows where next. Perhaps he wants to visit the next third world city called San Francisco. And we are trying to have mood music to go with it. And somehow my mind stumbled upon that guru from Antelope, Oregon. Remember the guy with the robes? And all of the devotees would wear the same robes that nymphomaniacs who thought they'd find spirituality in Oregon when all they found was, you know what? Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh told me that was his name. And she said his followers were the ones who poisoned the town salad bar so everyone would be too sick to vote and they could take over the town. Typical liberals, huh? I pushed my proboscis into the lair of seduction. Don't believe a word of those repressive religions. It was good. Real good. Rolls Royces and pretty followers, very good. That's why I died so young. That's a haiku from the imaginary Rajneesh, whatever his name is. You know, he died in 1990, lived in 1931, I always added up. You ever reach that point in life, everyone, you read the obit, immediately do the math. My math is so quick when it comes to obits now. It's faster than a supercomputer. 1939, 59. You know what I mean? You always do those numbers. That means I should have been dead in the year 2000. You know, you always do the quick numbers, No, the other day, it's terrible. I drove past the house that we had rented in 1989. I rented a house. So you look back 89, you do 99, 09, 21 years ago. Like a blink job. Now you go forward 21 years and it's eternity. There's nothing there. The movie stopped already. Everyone's wearing a little blue suit with a red star, and George Soros is 114 with transplanted kidney skin on his brain, and infantile lungs have been put, and he's still alive, and now he's running the world like, you know, the madman running the universe. If this keeps up, that's what's going to happen. It's going to be one world, and you're all going to be singing happy tunes. You won't be able to get any happy meals because they've been banned in San Francisco. But you will be able to get happy tunes with Obama's name written all over them. But 21 years from now, could you imagine what this is going to be like in 21 years? The blink of an eye, 21 years from now. That's already 2031. 2031, I'm going to be 90. Out of spite, I'd like to live to 90-something. Do you know that? Out of spite, I would like to be able to be on the radio 20 more years. Just to spite the communists the rest of my life. What, you think I'm going to be that lucky? The vitamins. I'm getting tired of it all, really, looking at it. It's so depressing, it's beyond belief what they're doing to this world. But we won a big victory. I mean, realistically, we knocked 60 of them out of the halls of power. Gone! Gone with the wind. They are knocked on their behinds. Gone. Like 10 pins. What I loved reading yesterday was the unions came up. The communist union leaders, the wonderful people, they said because of the hard work we did, we held on to the Senate. You hear? That's because of virtually no Senate races. I never saw anything like this. Denial. It's like Animal Farm. Yeah, it really helped. Sure, the American people are schmucks. Let me tell you something. If every Senate seat had been up for election like the Dems, I mean like the House, you would have seen a major upheaval in the Senate. You would have seen them all on their keisters. But, okay, you got to wait a little longer for this. You say, well, how come Carly Fiorina didn't win? She ran against Barbara Boxer. Answer, because Carly Fiorina was a fraud, not a conservative. She ran a middle-of-the-road campaign, advised by Democrat consultants, did not say one word about illegal aliens, didn't say one word about how to fix the economy. It was all about, vote for me because I'm not Boxer. What a great campaign. Same with Whitman. Let her go back to eBay now that she blew $140 million. The only people who profited were the ad agencies and her stupid advisors who tomorrow go to work for Communist Party USA. If someone asked them to work for the Communist Party, they'd recommend the same campaign. You want to win next time? I'm not in the business. Hire someone who knows what the people really want. I know what the people want. I can become the greatest campaign consultant this country has ever seen because I know what the people want more than any campaign advisor the country has ever seen. I have a direct link to the American people, particularly on the conservative side, more so than anybody in this country. And I can prove it. That's how my book became a raging bestseller with absolutely no media support whatsoever. A little teeny media support, that's all, not nothing. A little bit. It's all to do with this show and this audience. I know what the people wanted to hear. They weren't hearing it. That's why I'm joking around today. I mean, we got to take a breather. People don't want to hear this anymore. You know, has anyone in this show been to Indonesia? Does anyone know the history of Indonesia, the slaughter of the Chinese? You don't hear that from the morons in the Associated Press. The Washington Press Corps flying around with the great man. Not one of them notices the slaughter of the Chinese in Indonesia, the killing of the Catholics. You don't know about that one? You didn't read that in high school? Sacramento, Phil, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. My in-laws were immigrants from Indonesia. They came over here in the late 50s. They were kicked out by Sukarno and the communists who were usurping the Muslim religion and becoming a nationalist-type movement. My wife was about 3 months old. They had to go to Holland for 2 years and wait to come to the United States. They immediately became citizens. They are Christians, and that's the only reason they were kicked out. Her father was part Dutch. And so he wasn't a full-blooded Indonesian, and they were no longer welcome in that country. They almost
people do not know what went on between Sukarno and Suharto. They don't even understand. Because I don't blame people. It's not a current affair. But there was a mass slaughter of the Chinese in Indonesia as well. Are you aware of that?
Oh, absolutely. It's going on today. If you're not a Muslim in that country, you are not welcome, and you are a target.
Well, you shouldn't say that because Obama says it's a peaceful nation, wonderful people, they love everybody. Well, what in the world is he what is he doing there? Do you have any idea what the heck he's actually doing there?
Yeah, he's sitting there appeasing the Muslims and trying to probably make contacts or find out what the heck he needs to do to turn this country into an Indonesia.
Well, let's listen to clip 7 from Jakarta, the president himself.
You know, when you visit a place that you spent time in as a child, as president, it's a little disorienting. You know, now as president, I can't even see any traffic because they block off all the streets, although my understanding is that the traffic is
it's
pretty
nice tough. To be king.
Obviously, this is a short
period. All right, fine, yeah. He can't see any traffic because they blocked off the streets. I mean, it's unbelievable, right? That unto itself should live in infamy, that statement. How could a man like him, how could this man have wound up president? Do you have any idea, Phil?
Well, it was basically Acorn that stole the election, and the media did nothing but harp on anything conservative and lift this man up to like he's a god. I mean, that's the only way it can.
And now they're whitewashing the facts about his childhood in Indonesia, right?
I just hope that the Congress investigates this man and makes him prove he's eligible. I still have my doubts about that.
Let's put aside the eligibility issue for a moment. I go back to my principal point. It doesn't matter to me at this point whether he was a citizen at the time of his birth or not for one reason. He's been president for almost 2 years, so let's live with that. But the point that I've been making for 2 years is that he could not have even passed the background test sufficient to become his own Secret Service agent. That's a fact of reality. Because of his associations with Reverend Wright, Bill Ayers, and other communist radicals, he would have been rejected in the first round of investigation. Do you know that?
He couldn't have got a job in any municipality in this country. I tried to apply.
Well, how is he president then? How could this man be president then?
Because of the whitewash, the cover-up.
Because the vermin in the media. Right now, the vermin in the media are lying about his childhood in Indonesia. He has CNN coming out with a puff piece today, lying about the time he spent at a Muslim school, saying he was the model pupil, he was a Boy Scout, he helped the teacher clean the blackboard after school. This is like Pravda describing the childhood of Joseph Stalin.
Why do you think his school records are not being released? Because there's stuff damaging in those records. I know that he spoke his heart and mind in his writings, and his school records would show that.
Have you found a copy yet of my book?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, you know, I got to tell you something about that. It's not just the clerks that are hiding your book. I saw a person take a stack of your books and put them in the garbage can at Barnes & Noble here in Stockton.
Oh, I would like to have seen a picture of that. If you ever get anyone doing that, please take a cell phone picture. I'll have them arrested.
I tried to call you a couple weeks about that. I'm glad you mentioned your book. It was so funny. I said, hey, what the hell are you doing, man? He goes, well, Pete Book.
Yeah, what happened next?
He just turned red and walked off. He put the book back on the shelf.
Wow, it's that bad. I'm really upsetting him that much. Well, I'm sending you a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. That's the greatest story yet of my publishing career. I'm invigorated now. Play some Indonesia music for me on the Savage Nation. I need some inspiration. It's waning. I don't know what to eat tonight. That's all I'm thinking about. Terrible. It's really awful. You think of mortality, immortality, and all you want to do is think about dinner. I'm still getting over the Japanese lunch, the solo luncheon, with the illegal aliens next to me with the dirty boots. You know, one thing you got to say about the English, when I was over... Okay, turn it off already. I'm getting a migraine. When I was over in England 25 years ago, whenever, one thing I liked about England, I went into one of the pubs, like a little nicer pub, and it said no men in work clothes or muddy boots in ripped work clothes or muddy boots permitted. I like that. I mean, if you want to go to a pub with muddy boots, I don't have any. It's a different level of pubology. I like that they said that. They still had a touch of differential there. Now, I couldn't go into certain clubs, you know. I mean, I may pass for white, but I'm truly, you know, the fact is that they wouldn't want me either in the best of clubs there where the degenerates are known to hang out. So here we are. Here we are. God only knows what tomorrow will bring. But 21 years from now, my God, how many years more of Obama do we have to put up? 2 more years? I don't know who's going to save us. Well, we saved ourselves. They're not going to change at all. We've got men dying in Iraq, men dying in Afghanistan, and he wants to reach out to the Muslim world. And in the same breath, he attacks Israel. From a Muslim nation, he attacks the Jews. Did you hear this one? Oh, didn't make it to your... play it for them, Beowulf.
I've not had a full briefing on Israel's intentions and what they've communicated to our administration. But this kind of activity is never helpful when it comes to peace negotiations.
Uh-huh. He doesn't know what Israel's up to, you hear? He didn't get a full briefing on what Israel's up to. Maybe he could have a contact with Osama bin Laden. He'll give him a briefing. Listen to 09.
You know, I'm concerned that we're not seeing each side make the extra effort involved to get a breakthrough that could finally create a framework for a secure Israel living side and side by side in peace with a sovereign Palestine.
It's interesting he would say secure Israel and sovereign Palestine. I'm very cognizant of the use of language and words. He didn't say a sovereign Israel. He said a secure Israel living next to a sovereign Palestine, meaning, again, the Muslims would rule the Jews. But they'd be secure. They'd be happy little Jews being protected by Obama. Happy little protected Jews living in a sovereign Palestine. In other words, it would be reversed if he had his way. So as I say to you, this is amazing to listen to. The man goes to a Muslim nation and basically, what does he do here? Yeah, you heard what he did. And that's the story. Now we have a CNN doing the job that they're known for, the Crescent News Network. And I don't even want to play it anymore because it's all communism. And then you got a guy on MSNBC, more snotty nonsense by communists, with one of them, whose name I won't mention, saying that he's not a progressive, he's not a liberal, he's a socialist. Here's a man on television, owned by Microsoft, in clip 28.
Unlike you, I am not a progressive. I am not a liberal who's so afraid of the word that I had to change my name to progressive.
I'm not either.
Liberals amuse me. I am a socialist. I live to the extreme left.
Great.
The extreme left of you mere liberals.
Now let's listen to the next one.
I know this about my country. Liberals are 20% of the electorate. Conservatives are 41% of the electorate, okay? So I don't pretend that my views, which would ban all guns in America, make Medicare available to all in America, have any chance of happening in the federal government, okay? You can sit there and pretend.
All right. So you got the whole picture. That's what Bill Gates is funding now. That and a man who urinates on himself, they re-employed 3 days after firing him for violating election laws. That's what they have now, in addition to the other people from Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, on this network. I have no idea what MSNBC is all about. So they have a naked socialist boasting about it who would ban your guns, And what else would he do? He would like a single-payer medical system so you can pay even more of your money for malcontents and illegal aliens to get Cadillac health care plans. And God knows what else these lunatics would do. Why does Bill Gates fund this? Why does Microsoft fund this? Why does NBC fund this? Why do you buy light bulbs from General Electric? I mean, I'm not into boycotts, but my friends, think about what I'm saying to you. The president and CEO of General Electric is on this junket with Obama because I believe he is going to provide the largest turbine project in world's history to India, which is good. If any of the money flows back to America, I'd be quite surprised. My suspicion is most of the jobs will be in India. Most of the money will remain in India, and we'll see very little of it. But I ask you, why would you continue to buy light bulbs from a company that supports a man that would seize your guns? I'll be right back.
Savage.
So here are the top stories on the Savage Nation. Obama bashes Israel from Indonesia, a Muslim nation. Passengers await help on crippled cruise ship off the coast of Mexico. And there's a lot more. You don't want to hear it. There's enough. Your brain is cooking already. You got to go cook dinner, or you ate dinner. You're going to have dinner. You're not going to have dinner. There's flooding in Thailand, maybe. Maybe Sean Penn can go there now, direct from Haiti, and we can get rid of him. Maybe you can take Bill Maher with him. They can move together. 60 of them lost their seats. Can you imagine? If we only had a full Senate to vote on, we might get rid of the communist administration, the first one in American history. I mean, they get rid of Happy Meals in San Francisco. That would be, you know, be like getting rid of Happy Meals in San Francisco by fiat. This guy is like a Happy Meal. If we could only, you know what I'm saying, ban it from America. 1-800-44. Thank God he's been good so far that nothing went wrong because of all of the ships and the planes. You know, good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the ships at sea. I mean, thank God all the ships were at sea protecting him. I mean, it'd be a horrible thing, God forbid. I'm glad he's safe. Don't get me wrong. I'd like to see him come back. I'd like to see him roll up his sleeves and cure the economy by pumping even another $1 trillion into the so they could have more late-night construction projects than with no bids. But at least the roads are getting built somewhere. I don't know. I hear they're getting built. Here in San Francisco, they got cranes and lights. You can go blind driving over Doyle Drive going off. If you come off the Golden Gate Bridge, let's say you live in, you don't know what I'm talking about. You come off the Golden Gate Bridge going into the city now. I don't care what time of night it is. Boom, bang. They dug up graves at the Presidio. The woman, didn't matter. Progress must go on. And that's a big sign. Thanks to the Recovery and Reconnection Act, or whatever, the Racket and Recovery Act. Every time I look at it, I think of The Sopranos. I don't know why. My mind is very cinematic. When I see those cranes operating in the middle of the night, all I can think of is how many no-show jobs, how many guys are sitting around in helmets, you know, reading the newspaper. No, I've watched too much television. I admit it. Did anyone bid on that job here in San Francisco, these giant billion-dollar projects? I would like to. Look at all the unemployed guys have been calling today. Maybe they wanted a bid on a portion of the job. But then again, they didn't know the mayor or the governor or, you know, people like that. 1-800-449-8255. I'll be right back in the Savage Nation to talk about Obama in Indonesia, his hometown.
Savage. Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Listen up.
this came out today. I mean, does it matter to you that the Washington Post, the liberal newspaper, reports the following? Obama's Indonesian gay nanny and other things from his past. Does that matter to you? Well, it matters to the Washington Post. So let's look at the story, because you won't read it in your local paper. Obama's Indonesian gay nanny and other things from his past. With Obama visiting Indonesia today, the New York Times has a story that is chock full of interesting tidbits, they write, about Obama's time living in Indonesia as a child in the late 60s. For example, the Times reports that back then Obama was chubby, and that some of the locals refer to him as the boy who runs like a duck. I would say it's the boy who rules like a duck. Then, of course, there's this, and I'm quoting now, so don't blame me. His nanny was an openly gay man who, in keeping with Indonesia's relaxed attitudes toward homosexuality, carried on an affair with a local butcher, longtime residents said. The nanny later joined a group of transvestites called Fantastic Dolls, who, like the many transvestites who remain fixtures of Jakarta's streetscape, entertain people by dancing and playing volleyball. Apparently such a thing is not uncommon, as Indonesia has a relatively advanced drag culture. The Australian newspaper, The Age, reported in 2003. Transvestites, known in Indonesia as waria, are particularly prevalent in the tailoring and makeup artist professions, according to the paper. However, not everyone in Indonesia enjoys the drag queen volleyball games. The BBC reported that hardline Islamists broke up a transvestite beauty pageant in 2005. Finally, the Times relates a story from one of Obama's boyhood friends that some might say presage the future. Well, I don't even want to read it. It's boring. But anyway, he became president, and that's it. We don't know if it has any bearing upon his views of things. So first he was a communist, then a socialist, and then what? No one even knows. We have no idea what he is now.
I don't think that's going to make its way onto the White House website anytime soon, that story about his nanny.
Well, some would say it's what makes him a great president, in that he's so so diverse.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, and of course, as I point out in Trickle Up Poverty, from there at 10 years of age until college, he was mentored by Frank Davis Marshall, a communist, who, by the way, also authored the book Sex Rebel, under a pseudonym that recounted his sexual practices and orientations. Then when Obama began college at Occidental College, he was mentored by the openly gay professor that took gay students under his large wing. You know, and so therefore, let me add that to me it doesn't really matter, but it's very interesting. There's something interesting here. Does it matter? I mean, I didn't write this. The Washington Post did.
They're putting
it's all in his background. You know, see, there's really nothing typical about Obama's upbringing from the point of view of an American. And that's why he has no intrinsic love of America and no ability to connect with the average American, because he isn't one. That's really what it comes down to.
When he gets nostalgic, he thinks of Jakarta instead of the Midwest or New England in the fall. It's a different perspective. He doesn't, it's not fundamentally an American one.
No, it's just that he has no basic, shall I say, norm within him that's American, in plain English.
There you go.
There's no normative center to the man.
Yeah.
Then, of course, there's a new story. Mystery missile off California coast. Pentagon says don't know what it is. Appears to have been launched at sea. No sign that NORAD or NORTHCOM detected it. No one knows what it is. Maybe Big Sis can see it, you know.
Maybe she can pat it down.
What's this big deal about Bush coming out with a book? I mean, why is he suddenly so popular? I mean, he was a horrible president, wasn't he?
I don't know what they're thinking. Maybe they figure if they contrast Bush with Obama, they'll try to make Obama look good. Maybe that's the left-wing approach.
Well, I understand that Vice President Biden had a meeting about governmental transparency today, but unfortunately the meeting was closed to the press. I didn't make that up. Didn't make it up.
That's hilarious.
No, it's in the news. Biden holds a meeting about government transparency under the Democrats, but the meeting was closed.
Oh, God.
With President Obama out of the country, tweeting things in Asia, carefully not bowing this time, His trusty sidekick, Joe Biden, is left to find things to do back home. There's a big Diwali party tonight at the White House. The vice president will be there. And I don't know. I mean, he likes parties.
Clearly. He likes squirt gun fights, too, if the picture is
well, yes, but I don't know if they're accepted during a Diwali celebration. Are water guns part of a Hindu ritual?
Not that I know. That might not be adequately respectful. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, to me, the Democrats are nothing more than puppets of the George Soros communist agenda, period. Take over the world. Use puppets like them. It's a transparent administration in terms of its incompetence and its appetite for utopian collectivism. And, of course, in that role, Biden is certainly excels. There's no question that there's transparency about this man in that regard, don't you think?
I couldn't agree more.
You couldn't? Why not? You should agree more. You absolutely should agree more. Now, let's go to michaelsavage.com. Obama's childhood in Indonesian madrasas is hidden. That's the main story I put up on the right side.
Oh, yeah.
He was there from 67 until 71 while his mom was visiting. She was an anthropologist who went from village to village. And he was left to be mentored by the Indonesian Muslim teachers. They did a very good job of him. He became president, right?
Yeah, apparently they fixed his viewpoint to this very day.
Now, the real big story today is one. It's an obscure little story. I have to find it. Where is it? Because it's an amazing story. Oh, goodness. Where did Mike put it? Here it is. Not the gay nanny from the Washington Post. This is what I was looking for. This is a big deal. Obama visiting Muslim shrine in India. No plans to visit Hindu, Buddhist, or other shrines.
Oh, God.
He is only visiting a Muslim shrine. It's for some guy from the 16th century. He was a Mughal emperor. And he is visiting, in other words, a Muslim shrine. He has no plans to visit any holy place, any holy places of the Sikhs, or any Hindu holy places, Buddhist holy places, or Jain holy places. But most insulting, he does not plan to visit the Chabad house in Mumbai, that was the chief target of the jihad mass murderers who killed 173 people in November of 08, including this beautiful Jewish couple who were there peacefully. They were butchered like animals.
Oh, God, I remember
that. Once again, Obama manifests a solicitude for Islam that he certainly wouldn't dream of extending to other faiths. It's actually heartbreaking, truthfully, Beowulf.
It's sad. I remember that poor child whose parents were slaughtered during that thing.
In front of his eyes, he was saved by a nanny.
That's right.
1-800-449-8255. So the stories for today on the Savage Nation are many. I had interviews today that I turned down, the BBC and the NPR. I'll tell you about them later. And we asked, why is Obama attacking Israel from a Muslim country? Do you think it's right for a president to attack Israel when speaking in a Muslim country? And why is he de-emphasizing his Muslim roots? Why is the media so concerned about a positive portrayal of Obama's childhood? Then there's the mystery missile. The missile was fired off the coast of Southern California that the military so far claims it had nothing to do with. I don't know what it is, frankly. I have no idea. I can't even hazard a guess. I can't even make a joke about it. It's so ridiculous. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
I have talked about how the left wing is trying to force these so-called green technologies down our throat and to help our environment. But we really know it's just another way for them to help themselves to more money and power. And one of the ways they're trying to do this is through the EPA. Their idea, to increase passenger fuel economy up to 62 miles per gallon in 14 years. Joining us now from the Cato Institute is Patrick Michaels with a look into this. Patrick Michaels, welcome back to the Savage Nation. 62 miles a gallon sounds good.
Yeah, well, if the government gets its way, it's going to force people into cars that they really don't want. We're already seeing what happened with the Chevrolet Volt, which is very interesting. You know, if you buy a Volt, you get $7,500 back from the taxpayers. And the reason is because the Volt was supposed to be a special car, an all-electric vehicle. Well, it's not. General Motors got that subsidy for everyone by claiming it was that, but they knew full well that at high speed it was going to run just like a conventional hybrid car. So there's some kind of misrepresentation of the truth here in an effort to jimmy a lot of money out of the government.
Well, how does that work?
Well, GM for years said that this car was going to be a pure electric vehicle, that the gasoline engine would only serve as a generator. They knew for years that that wasn't the case. They certainly had to know the propulsion system of their car. And then GM became owned by us. And they still maintain this fallacy in order to get $7,500 back to everybody who bought one of these money-losing cars. To me, it's an outrage that because they had to know the nature of their car, and they weren't being straight with the American people who are their owners.
GM isn't the only so-called electric car. Do the others have this problem, too?
Well, one thing we're seeing with the Volt is that its range on electric only in the real world appears people are getting generally between 30 and 35 miles before the gasoline engine kicks in. That's not nearly the range that was advertised. For years, General Motors said that people were going to get 70 miles on the battery only. And we're also seeing the Nissan Leaf, which is a pure electric vehicle, getting less than its 100-mile electric-only range that was advertised. It looks like people are getting around 70. We're going to find that this technology has been oversold. It's interesting, and it's cute, and it's expensive, and it's oversold.
How could this be going on?
I think the government has been pushing things like the Chevrolet Volt for a long time. And in this particular administration, they are very committed to the green people who supported them in the presidential election in 2008. Remember, when Obama gave his inauguration speech, about the first subject he mentioned was global warming. And so they have to pay attention to that base.
I don't think these cars are as green as people like to think, as I point out in Trickle Up Poverty, an entire chapter on the solar scam.
No, now that the truth has come out about the Volt, after about 30 or 35 miles, it's pretty much like a conventional hybrid car, like a Prius. Why in the world should you take from your fellow taxpayers $7,500 because you bought a Prius-like vehicle?
Where do you think it goes from here?
Well, it's doubtless that Mr. Obama is going to direct his Environmental Protection Agency to produce very stringent fuel economy standards for cars. They proposed up to 62 miles per gallon just 14 years from now. Now, remember that that's a fleet average. People are still going to buy pickup trucks, they're still going to buy vans, so that passenger car is going to have to get closer to 80 miles to the gallon. Nobody knows how to do this. So we are forcing technologies that we have no idea will work or can work, and that's going to continue to happen in this administration.
What do you think they should do?
Well, I would recognize that generally there is a market pressure to produce efficient vehicles or to produce them efficiently. Why don't they just let the market work on this instead of trying to force things to happen? You know, when you force things to happen, it costs money. And that money, you might have kept in your pocket. You might have invested it in a company that produced efficient things. Instead, the government has taken it from you in a futile attempt to force technology.
What can we expect to see in the next few years?
I don't think you're going to see changes with regard to carbon dioxide emissions. I think they're going to continue to go down the road of expensive and ineffective emissions reductions. They have to, because that's their base, and they are stuck with it. You know, all this stuff happened while the government owned General Motors. You would wonder if the people have some right to oversight here. I'm wondering if the new Congress is going to investigate why they misrepresented the technology in the Volt in order to get a subsidy.
Yeah, but will they do that?
I think if this story gets out that they sold something that wasn't real in order to get taxpayer money or money to taxpayers to subsidize the purchasing of a car that they would normally not purchase, I think if that gets out, there will be a big hue and cry.
What can we, the people, do?
You could always write your congressman and say, hey, what was this $7,500 subsidy stimulus package, you know what, based upon? Why does the person who purchased this vehicle get that $7,500 when he doesn't get $7,500 if he or she purchases a Prius? That's the way it is. The government is going to continue to pressure people to do things that they don't want to do.
Thanks for the update, Patrick. As I said many times, believe me, I have worked to save the environment. It is natural to want to conserve our environment. I am an environmental conservative. But what the left is doing does nothing for the environment. It is just another of their attempts to take more and more of our power and our money. This is the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere. Obama really embarrassed himself today in India, and now he's doing the same thing in Indonesia. Now, remember, Mr. Obama grew up in Indonesia. In fact, he seems much more enthusiastic about visiting Indonesia than he does about visiting, well, New York.
I feel great affection for the people here. And obviously, you know, I have a sister who's half Indonesian. You know, my mother lived and worked here for a long time. And so the sights and the sounds and the memories all feel very familiar. And it's wonderful to be able to come back as president and hopefully contribute to further understanding between the United States and Indonesia.
Maybe you should focus your attention on the United States instead of Southeast Asia, Mr. President. Other presidents have made the same mistake in thinking that they were the president of the world.
You know, when you visit a place that you spent time in as a child, as president, it's a little disorienting. You know, now as president, I can't even see any traffic because they block off all the streets, although my understanding is that Jakarta traffic is pretty tough. Obviously, this is a short visit. It's a shorter visit than I would like. My hope is that we're going to be able to come back and maybe bring the kids and visit some places outside of Jakarta.
To me, it's nothing but a vacation for him and his family. And guess who he's trying to reach out to?
With respect to outreach to the Muslim world, I think that our efforts have been earnest, sustained. We don't expect that we are going to completely eliminate some of the misunderstandings and mistrust that have developed over a long period of time. But we do think that we're on the right path.
No, sir, I believe you're on the wrong path. And then he attacks Israel.
I have not had a full briefing on Israel's intentions and what they've communicated to our administration. But this kind of activity is never helpful when it comes to peace negotiations.
I can't believe this. Outreach to Muslims by attacking Israel? Which side is he on? How long have I told you that the media is openly socialist? Well, now they're admitting it openly. Listen.
Unlike you, I am not a progressive. I am not a liberal who's so afraid of the word that I had to change my name to progressive.
I'm not either.
Liberals amuse me. I am a socialist. I live to the extreme left.
Right.
The extreme left of you mere liberals.
I guess the Peacock Network is showing its true colors.
I know this about my country. Liberals are 20% of the electorate. Conservatives are 41% of the electorate, okay? So I don't pretend that my views, which would ban all guns in America, make Medicare available to all in America, have any chance of happening in the federal government. Okay? You can sit there and pretend that liberals should run more liberal in conservative districts.
All right, let's move on. I want to show you some good writing. It's a popular novel. Don't get scared. Don't get frightened when I say book. I know many of you don't read. You just text. And you think that using your two thumbs makes you equal to Shakespeare. But before the two-thumb method, there was a thing called penmanship. Before the two-thumb message, there was a thing called books. Before the two-thumb message, there were movies based upon books. And the other night I couldn't sleep. It was around 1 in the morning. I got up and I watched a movie. And it was Priestley's Honor, which I had seen years ago and forgotten how good it was. And the reason I became fascinated again by Priestley's Honor is because it was written by probably one of the most, the finest novelists that I've ever read. In some ways, Richard Condon. Now, he wrote The Manchurian Candidate. He wrote Mile High, which I told you was about Prohibition and how it was created, how Prohibition had been created by a man who would then take over the rackets of the booze racket. He put in Prohibition. How? By funding women's groups who wanted to ban alcohol. And once the alcohol became illegal, he was ready with the smuggling the alcohol. And it's an amazing book, very much like the drugs in America today. Who knows who's funding the anti-drug hysteria in America? What do we really think? Shouldn't things really change? Why do you think there's such a battle against legalizing drugs? I mean, I'm not in favor of drug usage. I think it's a curse and a scourge, and it's destroyed our country. But you're at a point where you don't know what's destroying it more, the number of people incarcerated, the amount of police we have watching everything we do, or the drugs themselves. So anyway, so he wrote the Manchurian Candidate. He wrote Mile High, and he also wrote Priestley's Honor. So I started to read. So I watched the movie about 30 minutes, but then I pick up the novel. I just happened to get the three of his books in the hardcover again. I had ordered them. And I start to read Priestley's Honor, and I found out that the movie was very true to the book. They copied almost the work. Richard Condon was actually one of the screenwriters for the movie, directed, by the way, by John Huston, one of his funny, while he was still living. And his daughter, Angelica Huston, was in it. Jack Nicholson, if you remember, was in that movie. Now, remember, 1985 is a long time ago. 85, 95, 30, 25 years ago. It's hard to believe, right? If I say 1985, you believe it's 25 years ago. I do reversals and backwards now. So I say, 1985, why, that was just yesterday? No, it was 25 years ago. So I said, wait a minute, what does that really mean? Well, put yourself in 1985 and say 25 years ago, that would be 1960. Impossible to believe. Okay, so I'm going to read you from the book and I'm going to show you what good writing is. Just sitting in that hotel lobby under a shiny green balaboonal hat, which by itself could return millinery to a leading place in the arts, she had slowed down the lobby traffic, as Charlie could see from across the lobby, to minus 9 miles an hour. He studied everyone who was within sight of her in the room, pitying poor Paulie, and he imagined that he could see old men's eyes getting misty, room clerks and bystanders developing erections, and every woman who saw her realizing that she was doomed to hostile dreams that night. She had turned Charlie's legs to water just by sitting there when he came into the lobby. Now, that's the character, the Jack Nicholson character. And the femme fatale was played by Kathleen Turner, who I didn't think was that fantastic, but Charlie Partan is apparently in love with her, right? Now, I want to read you one sentence when he falls in love with her. And he flies out to L.A. to meet this woman he fell in love with at a wedding, a mob wedding. And he meets her in L.A., and he's courting her now. He's totally in love with her, absolutely in love with her after one day. So they get into a car after a restaurant, and they drive up the Pacific Coast Highway. Well, I'm going to read you one paragraph. I want to show you what writing can do. They drove to the ocean, then up the Pacific Coast Highway, and Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he had ever felt in his life. Do you hear a sentence like this? I'm going to read it again. He's in love now. He's a gangster. He's a killer. And yet he's in love with this woman. They drove to the ocean, then up the Pacific Coast Highway, and Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he had ever felt in his life. I thought that was an amazing sentence. I don't know if people could even write about love in that way anymore, what it does to a human heart. The illusion of love, because it's all an illusion, as you well know. Remember, I started by saying we're going to talk about illusions and allusions. So now we have the illusion of romantic love and what physiological and emotional effect it has on this character, which Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he ever felt in his life. Now, maybe you remember those feelings from when you were 17. I don't know. Remember what it was like when a girl liked you and you liked her? Oh, my God. They say the man feels he can conquer the world. Yeah, well, click, click, 3 years later, get back to me on that one. How about when love leaves you? How about when the illusion leaves you? What happens to the man or to the woman when that illusion, that romantic illusion, leaves you? Well, we could talk. We could spend a lot of time talking about what love is and what love isn't and how it was a rather recent phenomenon. It didn't even exist in biblical times. The whole concept of love is kind of a modernistic idea. There was no love in the ancient days, incidentally. Love, the idea of romantic love, as I understand it, is rather recent, last few hundred years. For most of mankind throughout history, marriage was based upon something other than love, other than romantic love. And you could joke and say based upon lust. Okay, fine. We know that's a given. But it was based basically on a contract between a man and a woman, sort of a business contract, to go into business together, the business of raising a family and building lives. That's what marriage really is at the end of the day. And depending upon your business partner, your business will either thrive. Well, your business partner and luck and circumstances, of course. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. Oh, there's another great line in here. I got to read this to you. Hold it. Hold it. Listen to this one. So we're talking about Prezi's honor. And what's the dedication in the front of the book? Listen to this. You're going to love this one. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships from the book Antigone. Can you believe that? I'm going to read that to you again. Many of you think that you can lock out fate with money, or you can lock out fate with a guard or a security guard, or, you know, calling 911, or being surrounded by powerful people. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships. How many of you have not experienced that in your life? How many of you want to call this show right now and tell me what fate has done to you when least expected? How's that for a show topic? And the phone number, you know, 1-800-449-8255. I'll read it once again. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships, from Antigone. How has fate influenced your life? When has fate entered your life and turned it from one form to another? From poor to rich, from rich to poor, from health to sickness? From marriage to divorce? You want to go into what fate did to you? Now, I tell you, we all know about fate. Remember I read the story when I wrote years ago, 2 years ago was it already? Psychological Nudity, and I talked to you about the Leather Man. Many of you love that story because it was so bittersweet. The father's friend, the Leather Man, who rose from the poverty of the Lower East Side where he didn't have a penny, and he became wealthier than my father did by going into a certain business which took off in the 1950s, and he moved to a much better house than we had. We lived in an attached house. He was able to move to a detached house, so to speak, out in Long Island, you know, with a lawn all around it as opposed to an attached wall. Now, that was considered much wealthier. While we had a used car, he had a new car. While we had a flat living room, he had a sunken living room. While we had a phonograph, he had a stereo. You get the picture, right? So things went on very well for him. Soon he had expanded the Leather Man. He had a chain of leather stores. And then lo and behold, as fate would have it, I go away. I go out on my own road. I travel to the Fiji Islands. I leave the entire kith and kin behind. I want to set out on my own road. I know if I stay in New York, I'd be dead within a short... I wouldn't be dead. My soul would be dead. I wouldn't have gotten anywhere in life. I just was not cut from the same cloth as my kin and kith. I wasn't. I was always different. I was always driven by other. Doesn't mean I'm better, okay? It means I'm different. It's as simple as that. So I had to follow my own star. Whatever the influences were, I knew I had to get out of New York. So I left in 67 or so, 68. And the rest was an astounding ride. What a roller coaster ride it's been. What I'm saying is, I come back from that road to the plant collecting, the Fiji, the Samoa, the Tahiti, the plant. And now I'm a man. I have a child. I'm married. I had left when I was still really a boy. And the Leather Man had been riding high. I come back a few years later. I am sitting in my living room. I think my father was dead. Or actually, to tell you the truth, I think I came back from my father's funeral. Truthfully, I mean, I don't remember. A lot of it's jumbled up in my head. And lo and behold, who's sitting there, shrunken up in the chair? The Leatherman, who, by the way, I'm not here to mock him. I love this man. I loved all of my father's friends. There wasn't one man in the entire circle that I didn't have a fondness for. I loved all of these guys. I loved all of my uncles. It was an amazing time. I don't know what's happened to the world. But I had a big heart for these people. They were all kindly, good guys. So anyway, he's sitting there, shrunken down. He was a heavy cigar smoker. Heavy cigar smoker. And he looks up at me, and his eyes are wandering. And he says, Michael, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. I didn't know what happened to him. He says, I have nothing. I lost everything. And he wound up living at this point now with his children back in a relative's apartment in the slums of New York that he had left 30 years before. He lost his house. He lost his business. Everything. The fortunes had changed. Fate had changed. And here he was. His eyes were bewildered. He didn't know how this could happen to him. And he looked at me and he said, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. Then he says this. Then he says, I wish God had only given me cancer instead of this. I said, don't say that. Well, lo and behold, he was dead within a year from brain cancer. That's an absolutely true story. It's in Psychological Nudity. It's an example of what fate is and not tempting fate. And don't ask God for something because he's liable to hear you.
Savage.
So where was I? Oh, so I was talking about fate. That was one of the things. I mean, I've touched on an awful lot in this show so far. And many of you probably didn't know where I was coming from when I said we're going to do books. But I told you that if we do something that's of interest to me, it will lead back and forth in and out of the news and current events anyway. It's all interrelated. I could read the Bible and show you how the Bible is related to what's going on in the world today. I can show you that in and out and out and in. But again, that's too obvious. That's too hucksterish. And so I'm not going to do it. I don't really want to do the hokum thing. You know, I'm not Marjo. I'm not the Marjo of talk radio. Look up Marjo. It was a very funny movie in its day. You know, the revival tent guy. I don't want to do Marjo. You know, there are people in the business who are very good Marjos. So if you want to call the show, we can talk. I wanted to hear from Fate. That's right. Like if I were driving in a car somewhere in America, let's say I was the man who owned $25 billion worth of gold and I hate Michael Savage and I'm tuning in to see if he's putting me down again and wants me arrested. And all of a sudden the guy's talking about fate and this and that. And he reads from the book where he said nothing can stop fate, in other words. Was that true? Can nothing stop fate? How many times has fate turned people's fortunes around? People have thought that they were immune, couldn't be touched. So I gave you an example of a pedestrian example. In my family constellation, in my childhood's constellation of what fate has done. We're all touched by fate. Now, I don't want to tempt fate, but I myself am not as believing in fate as much as I am in self-determination, truthfully. I truly believe in willpower altering fate. Let me put it to you that way, because if you start to believe that everything is fateful or predestined, well, you may as well, you know, just be a nothing, you know. You may as well just collect the old government check and eat the government cheese. You know, and press D, that's all, and scream about the rich that they owe you something. I have seen in my own life that I had to put a lot of effort into things to move the earth. I don't want to give you the hokey thing, but when I was way down, no matter what I did, I was like there's so much I want to say. This has opened up so much in my own talking and thinking, I don't even know where to begin. I have recently recollected all of my journals. I lost them. I collected all of my writings going back to 1966. I've collected them. And they're all neatly assorted in various boxes. And I don't know whether I'm getting ready to do something or leave the earth. I really don't know why I'm doing it all. I have a new assistant who broke into a storage shed for me and found them. I thought I had lost a lot of this. Every writing I've ever had that's significant, all my journals and whatnot. So I remember the early days of writing and how my life was altered by fate and by certain events. But I remember I had a friend who really never amounted to anything. I don't particularly like the guy. He's a backstabber. I won't mention him. But I remember him writing that life is like you're like a leaf in a stream. he wrote, when we were both trying to be writers. And we're nothing but a leaf in a stream, and we get caught up in the stream, and wherever the stream takes us, that's where we end up as a leaf. That never struck me as the way I wanted to look at my life. It is certainly true that no matter what you do sometimes, things are not going to work out the way you want them. I don't know how many years I tried and struggled in so many different ways, and it was fruitless in some regard. And I used to write in my journals that I am like a wildcatter. I'm like an early Texas wildcatter. And every well that I have drilled has come up dry. And I remember writing it after 15 years of trying to hit pay dirt. I was hitting dry wells. And remember, I had two children. I did everything right. I got the degrees. I got the PhD from a great university. I published books. But society had changed on me. The left wing had taken over America. And no longer did work count. No longer did quality count. No longer did effort count. No longer did anything count other than race and gender. And so they started to push unqualified women and minorities into positions that they were not qualified for. It was called affirmative action. And they ruined my life for many years.